This is WMUK's West to Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Sevilla Mann talks with agriculture expert Mark Longstroth. The educator at the Michigan State University Extension Service tells us what we can expect from this year's fruit crop in Southwest Michigan. But first, a study from Harvard on equality and opportunity in the United States finds that location matters. For instance, the New York Times analysis of their report says that if you're poor and you live in the Kalamazoo area, it's better to live in Berry County than in Kalamazoo or Calhoun County. Jamie Fogel is a pre-doctoral fellow at Harvard and part of the research team for the Equality of Opportunity Project. Jamie Fogel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is this study getting at? What are you trying to find out?
We're basically trying to understand how the place you grow up affects your economic outcomes as an adult. So what we did was we took a large administrative data set of economic outcomes, and we were able to link children to their parents. And by linking children to their parents, we're able to generate a measure of economic mobility. We did a number of measures, but the primary one we focused on was what is the expected income as a young adult of kids whose parents were at the 25th percentile of the income distribution. That means parents who were earning about $30,000 when their children were little. And we looked at this measure all across the United States to see how much it varied. We saw that it did vary very significantly from place to place. And then we asked ourselves, is it something about this place that has an effect for children? Or is it something about the type of people who live in different places? So the question, of course, then is, if it's something about that place, is it the case that if you take a family, move them to a place that has higher mobility outcomes for children, then those children will experience higher mobility outcomes? And so then we took advantage of the fact that we are able to observe people moving in our data set, looked at a large number of moves throughout as many sets of counties and metro areas in the country as we were able to observe, and said, when people move, do they exhibit characteristics in terms of mobility of the place they move to? And that's exactly what we found. And by doing this, we were able to identify the causal effect of living in one place versus another. So the conceptual experiment is to say, take someone and have them grow up in Grand Rapids, then take the exact same person, have them grow up in Kalamazoo. How would their outcomes differ?
Can we say that there are some things about certain cities, certain counties, certain metropolitan areas, some things that they share, which show that people who are at the lower end of the income ladder are better off in those places? Are there some things that those places do which do make it better for people who are not as well off?
Yes. I want to be very clear that what we've found is that places do have an effect, and we haven't necessarily figured out why those places have an effect. And so I don't want anyone to think, you know, we have solved that problem. That being said, we looked at a range of factors that characterize places that have low mobility for children. We found five factors that stand out. Places that have low mobility tend to have high levels of racial and economic segregation, high levels of income inequality, poor schools, low levels of social capital or civic engagement, and low share of two-parent households. Now, it's not that these factors are necessarily what causes low mobility. And it's not necessarily the case that by changing these factors in a certain place, you will necessarily change outcomes. But these are what's correlated with mobility outcomes. And these are probably good places for further study.
Does a place that is better for children from poor families on average, is that place any worse off, any worse of a place to live for a family which is wealthier or perhaps is somewhere in the middle or higher on that economic ladder?
Not necessarily. It's not necessarily the case that places that help poor children also hurt rich children. So the gains of the poor children do not necessarily come at the expense of gains for wealthier children. A good example in West Michigan is Ottawa County, which we find to be one of the best places in the country for poor children. A kid who grows up at the 25th percentile of the income distribution will expect to see their wages at age 26 rise by $4,000 relative to the national average. But it's also a pretty good place for kids further up the income distribution. For average income kids, they see gains relative to the national average of over $3,000. For kids at the 75th percentile, it's over $2,000. And for kids in the top 1%, they still do over $1,000 per year better than the national average. So it's not the case that in Ottawa County, the poor kids do well at the expense of the rich kids. It really is good for everyone. Now, that's not always the case, but there isn't a strong correlation between outcomes for the poor and outcomes for the rich.
So since you mentioned Ottawa County, the headline on the MLive article about the study from Harvard says, to get kids out of poverty, Harvard study says move to Ottawa County now. Is that a little oversimplified?
Yes. We have found that Ottawa County does have a strong positive effect for kids, but it doesn't explain everything. There are a lot of factors that go into kids' well-being that are not explained by place. So we certainly don't want to, you know, want to be too much in the business of giving people advice on exactly where to live. We haven't solved this whole problem, but Ottawa County does look good on our measures. Poor kids from Ottawa County do pretty well.
And that headline says now, because part of the emphasis in this study and in the story they did on it is that the earlier in life that someone moves to one of these areas, the better off they're likely to be. Explain that a little bit. In other words, does moving when you're three to an area like Ottawa County help significantly as opposed to moving there when the child is, say, 10?
Yeah, that's a really good point. What we find is the effect of every year of exposure to a place matters. It's roughly the same effect per year. But if you move to a better place when you're three, you spend more time there. So you get to accumulate 15 years worth of exposure to that place before you're 18, versus if you move there later and you experience fewer years. So the effect of each additional year is about the same. But when you add up all the years you spend there, moving there earlier is better.
I can hear some of my listeners right now in my head, perhaps seeing them on the WMUK Facebook page, wondering how it is that Kalamazoo County fares so poorly in this study for mobility, because here in Kalamazoo, we have the Kalamazoo Promise for the Kalamazoo Public School System, where students, regardless of income, regardless of grades, if they graduate and get accepted, they have a scholarship that's going to pay their tuition and fees at any number of private colleges, all state universities, all community colleges in the state. Does that factor at all into this study?
Well, that's an interesting point. And in our study, we don't really observe the Kalamazoo Promise because we need to measure kids at an old enough age that they're likely to be out of school and that their incomes have stabilized to some extent. So we use kids at age 26 because at that point, incomes have generally stabilized somewhat. There might still be some kids in school, but there is more stability and so on. Now, the kids who are affected by the Kalamazoo Promise aren't old enough to be included in our study. So it's certainly possible that the Kalamazoo Promise did wonders for mobility, but it would be affecting kids who are just a little bit too young to be included in our numbers.
So if we're going to find that out, there has to be another study.
Exactly.
Are there things that if a mayor of a city was reading this study, if a school board member or a superintendent were reading this study, might jump out at them and might say that there are public policy decisions that can be made which influence whether or not a town or an area is going to be a good place for someone to get economic mobility?
Yeah, so I would say that the primary takeaway from our study should be that places do matter. So if I were a policymaker, a mayor, a school administrator, I would take heart in knowing that I have the ability to really make a positive difference. Now, I don't think that our study necessarily says how they should do that. I think there's a lot of excellent work being done by a number of researchers in a number of fields on how to improve schools, how to provide social programs that help kids all up and down the income distribution. And so I think that you should take away from our study that these things matter and that places matter and that you can have an impact. But I don't think that we have solved the problem. And I think there's room for further research by us and others. And there's a lot of really great research out there on these topics.
Place matters. Are there other things that matter as well? And I guess I'm wondering, when you're trying to study this, is it possible, can it be teased out? In other words, how much geography plays into something and how much maybe there are other factors which play into whether or not a family is able to attain some sort of mobility?
Sure. So place matters. Kids' outcomes are also very much contingent on their parents' economic status. So poorer parents tend to have poorer kids. Wealthier parents tend to have kids who end up wealthier. So the characteristics of your family, they matter, and they matter probably in ways that aren't captured by income as well. And while place matters, while your family situation matters, they don't explain everything. There's still a lot that comes down to very idiosyncratic things that we don't measure in our survey, and you can, I'm sure, imagine what some of those things might be, and it's different in every case. So where you grow up, who your parents are, that isn't everything. There's still a lot more in there.
But going back to that MLive article about getting kids out of poverty by moving to Ottawa County, as you said, it doesn't explain everything. But if you are a family which is struggling a little bit, but does have the opportunity to move, and sometimes people don't, but for a family that does it make sense to do some research about counties where you can go and where your family can get some sort of mobility to try to move up the ladder?
I think it does. I think it's consistent with the fact that we have found that places matter. We don't know exactly what it is about the place that matters. We don't know exactly how the characteristics of the county might interact with your particular family. So you probably want to do more research than just looking at our study and determining what would be best for your family. But we think and we hope that our results will be taken into consideration that can be helpful to people.
If you were looking around Michigan, you mentioned Ottawa County. Are there other areas that someone would look at and say, this is a place where it might not be a bad idea to end up?
So Ottawa County does extremely well, both by national standards and by standards of Michigan. Pisaukee County does quite well, southeast of Traverse City. And Huron County, at the tip of the thumb of Michigan, those all do especially well in Michigan.
And are there any things that jump out to you that say that these areas have this in common or that in common? Or could it be a number of different things that contribute to this?
Well, I want to go back to the five factors we found that correlate closely with mobility. And those are high levels of racial and economic segregation, high levels of income inequality, poor schools, low levels of social capital and civic engagement, and a low share of two-parent households. So in general, across the country, places that have low mobility do tend to have those five things in common. But there are a lot of other things. You know, there are some places that do well on those characteristics, but still fare poorly in terms of mobility, and vice versa.
You mentioned that there's probably room for more study here. What do you think the next researchers, whether it be you or maybe somebody else, are there other things that they can dig down into? Or do you think there are other areas that they should delve into to try and get at maybe some of the harder questions that are out there in terms of how linked poverty and geography are?
I think one of the important questions are, what sort of policies work on a much more refined level? I think we can look at policies at an individual school level. What are schools doing that are helping kids or hurting kids? What are the characteristics of schools or school districts that are particularly successful? And what are the characteristics of social programs, whether they be young childhood education, whether they be substance abuse resources, any number of resources that might help people. And there might also be certain labor market characteristics of places. What types of interventions can places do to help the economy in a way that it to not only grow the economy, but to provide access to the economy for lower income people who might have a harder time accessing the economy and participating in the labor market in an effective way.
From a pure research standpoint, was this an interesting sort of thing to dive into? And were there things along the way which surprised you about the link between geography and economic mobility?
This was very interesting because we were looking at a national data set and able to see how the entire country varies and fares in these measures. So that was very interesting. In terms of what surprised us, we didn't really know what to expect when we went into it. One of the things that we did find, though, is that which shouldn't necessarily be surprising, but was striking, was that there is a huge amount of variation across the country. Some places do very well, some places do very poorly. So when we or others are asked, is the United States a place that's good or bad for mobility? The answer is it depends. Some places are great, some places are poor. And so in the political debate about that question, there isn't really a clear answer. Some places are good, some places aren't. It certainly seems possible that the United States could be a great place for mobility, given that some places have figured out, but other places don't and probably have a lot of room to grow.
Jamie Fogel, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Jamie Fogel is a pre-doctoral fellow at Harvard. He was also part of the research team for the Equality of Opportunity Project. Links with more information about the Harvard study on the link between opportunity and geography in the United States can be found at WMUK.org.
This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We're speaking with agricultural expert Mark Longstroth. He's an educator with the Michigan State University Extension. Based in Pawpaw, he specializes in, among other things, fruit crops. Longstroth tracks their progress throughout the state. We spoke about this season's prospects, what happens when the supply of fruit outstrips demand, and the health of the region's honeybees. Predictions are tricky, I'm sure. I don't know how much you can say in advance about what the fruit crops are going to look like in a season. What can you say at this point about how things are looking for this year?
Oh, right now, most of the fruit crops look really good. We had another really cold winter, and it caused injury to mostly wine grapes and peaches and some injury to blueberries, but it didn't hurt the apples or the cherries particularly a great deal. Generally, Lake Michigan protects us from cold air coming across the lake, but sometimes we get cold air coming in from the southwest, so the southwest Michigan here doesn't get quite as much protection sometimes. And we got down to minus 20 in January and in February, so that was twice, and generally wine grapes and peaches and blueberries don't like it if it gets down below minus 10. So we have seen some damage there. We didn't have any spring frost that caused us any damage. So generally, bloom has been pretty productive for us. And that varies quite a bit across the state. You know, we're just finishing, we have finished the bloom of the tree fruits, the cherries and the apples and the peaches down here in the southwest, but they're still in bloom up around Traverse City. And if we get nice, warm, sunny days, the bees really like that, and they come out and work the blossoms real hard, so we get a good fruit set. And if we get cold, wet, windy days, the bees don't like that, and they stay in the hive. The flowers have to be pollinated within a day or two of when they open, generally, to set fruit. But here in southwest Michigan, it looks like we're going to have a pretty good apple crop. We'll have more peaches than we had last year. We'll still have plenty of blueberries. We produce the fifth largest crop that we had ever produced last year, and I thought that we had significant injuries. So I expect that we'll do quite well with blueberries. And cherries, they're worried about having too many cherries now, so it's a nice worry to have.
They're worried about having too many cherries?
Yeah, too many cherries. Fruit responds to the law of supply and demand. So if you have more cherries than they want, the price will go down. If you don't have enough cherries for what they want, then the price will go up and people will look for cherries. In cherries, we have a marketing order, a federal marketing order, and they will look and see what the market for cherries is going to be, maybe 500 million, and then try to estimate the crop. And they will try to, they have what they call a diversion, where a grower can say, okay, I'm not going to harvest these cherries, and he'll get a diversion certificate. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that they decide that they're not going to harvest 10% of the crop here in Michigan. And so that means that all the growers would normally not harvest 10% of their crop, but there'll be growers that want to harvest 100% of their crop, and there'll be other growers that'll be quite happy to harvest nothing and get diversion certificates and then sell those to the people that it's really a complicated market. But that's, too many cherries means that I might not be able to harvest them all because I might have more than the market needs.
We had some cold weather the night of May 19th over to the 20th. Did that have any effect on the fruit crop?
Oh, no. Perhaps up in the Traverse City area where they're still in bloom, we were really lucky. We got down just to around freezing, but very few places went below freezing. The flowers and the green fruit generally aren't hurt by temperatures at freezing. It's temperatures below freezing, and the magic number for me is about 29 degrees. When you get to 29 degrees, you expect to see some injury. When the plants just first start to grow, when they're at swollen bud and you look at them and think, oh, you know, I can tell that they're starting to grow, they can generally take temperatures down below 20 degrees or much lower without any damage. But by the time you see the flower buds coming out, then 25 degrees will generally hurt them. And then 28 is the magic number for bloom. And so 28 would kill like maybe 10% of the open apple or cherry blossoms, and 25 would kill almost all of them. And we didn't get down to 28 anytime this year. We had a really cold freeze and got down to around 29 degrees at the beginning of May, end of April. And I was quite pleased that we skated through then. It didn't hurt the magnolias or the apricots or the sweet cherries that were in bloom then. So we've had really good conditions, and we've been pretty lucky, like I say, that we've had generally when each of our fruit crops bloom, we've had a spell of warm weather when the bees can get out and work. So that's why they're worried about too many cherries, and that's why they feel good about peaches, and they feel good about apples.
You mentioned bees. Beekeepers across the U.S. reported losing more than 40% of their colonies over the last year, I think April 2014 to 2015. And Michigan, from what I see, did a little better than its neighbor states. The average loss was below 30%, but that still sounds like a lot of honeybees lost. Is that an issue for Michigan tree fruit?
Yes and no. I mean, we managed to get lots of hives. The person that works with beekeepers said that our losses were down, considering the cold winter, that our losses were down. Most of the losses that occurred last year occurred during the season. A huge part of that was during the season for various reasons. So the growers pay a beekeeper to come in and bring in a set number of hives, so many per acre. Like in blueberries, we recommend 1 to 2 hives for every acre of blueberries. And the grower is going to pay the beekeeper anywhere from $50 to $60, $70 for each hive. And so that's a major source of income. The beekeeping business is quite complicated. After last year's winter, most Michigan beekeepers leave a few hives here in Michigan, and most of them go to Florida. And in Florida, they build their hives up. They will often split them and make two hives out of one by getting a new queen and putting it in half of the colony. And then the ones that weren't split will go to California to pollinate almonds, and then they all come back here to Michigan. We've had really strong hives in general. In the last 2 weeks, I've had 3 calls from people who have swarms of bees that have settled down in their yard, and they're trying to find somebody to get rid of them. And generally those swarms are coming from a commercial hive that was really strong and thought things are really great. You know, we're here in the middle of a big apple orchard that's in full bloom. We got lots of bees. We got lots of food. Let's make another hive. And they'll fly off and look for a place. And the beekeeper's quite excited about that because he wants to keep that hive. So you try to figure out who's got the closest orchard and call them and find out who their beekeeper is and then call the beekeeper and tell them that there's a swarm at such and such a place. And they'll show up with a hive, and the swarm is sending out scouts to look for another hive, and they find this really nice hive sitting next to them, so they'll move into it, and the beekeeper has another hive. So the fact that they're splitting means that the hives, as they come in here, are fairly strong. An awful lot of the hives that spend the season will spend their summer here in Michigan in areas where there are lots of flowers, wildflowers, during the summer, or pollinate summer crops like squash, pumpkins, and other things that need to be pollinated.
Do you have an issue in this part of the state in southwest Michigan with, I believe it's called colony collapse disorder? I hope I'm not confusing things there.
No. I'm not aware of, and colony collapse disorder is where the colony, most of the workers just disappear. I'm not aware that we have a big problem with that here in Michigan. Of course, now someone will call in and say, you know, I had it happen to me, or I had it happen to me. We're more concerned about using pesticides safely in the orchard when we've got bees in the orchard, because we've paid, you know, like I say, $60, $70 per hive to bring these bees in. But it's rainy, and now I have to put a fungicide on. And so we've spent a fair amount of time talking about pesticides and pesticide safety. A lot of people blame pesticides for this colony collapse disorder, but it looks like it's really a result of multiple stresses that are on the bees, the fact that they get moved around a lot, and there are viruses and there are mites in the hive that spread the viruses. And so it seems like it's a combination of multiple factors that are just too many stresses on the bees and the colony.
It sounds though like if you are going to be treating with a pesticide, you do have to be somewhat careful around honeybees.
Oh yeah, very careful. Generally, you know, we don't want them to use any insecticide, anything that would kill an insect. There are a few that are used during bloom, and they're certified as bee safe, but even those we don't want to use. We don't want to spray any kind of pesticide at all when the bees are out actively foraging. So we will put the sprays of fungicides on early in the morning or late in the evening or even at night when the bees are in their hives, so they're not exposed. Even if they're sprayed with something that's relatively harmless when they're flying around, it'll knock them down and they might not get up depending on what's in the spray. It's not necessarily the pesticide, but perhaps some of the other things that were mixed in the spray. We call them surfactants that make the spray spread out. Bees are coated by a waxy cuticle. That's how they keep the water in. And if I hit them with a detergent or a penetrating oil, that's not good for them. So we've really stressed the last couple of years that, you know, if you have to spray, let the beekeeper know and do it during the hours when the bees aren't actively foraging.
Mark Longstroth of the MSU Extension, thanks so much for your time.
You bet.
Mark Longstroth is an educator with the Michigan State University Extension. We spoke about the state of this year's fruit crops. By the way, Longstroth says local strawberries should be hitting southwest Michigan markets soon. WMUK's full interview with Longstroth is on our website, wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.